and Ampersand is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Wolastoqwell and the Mi'kmaq.
Hi, I'm Jenilyn Albert.
And I'm Rebecca Salazar.
And you're listening to Elm and Ampersand,
a poetry podcast recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick. So it is March 8th.
How are we already in March?
I don't know. It's sunny again. The light has come back. Fredericton is melting and or entering that season called sidewalk parkour.
Yes.
Where none of the sidewalks exist except for briefly downtown. So you're hopping back and forth between snowbanks and trying not to fall into the massive, like, icy slush hells in every corner. Yeah, so we just walked over here through that slushy nonsense from Westminster Books after a poetry pylon reading featuring launches for Best Canadian Poetry 2019 and what the poets are doing to pretty new anthologies. And we have the editors here today.
Yeah, and Rebecca, who else was reading at that Westminster event?
Yeah, so we had Sue Sinclair and Nick Thran were reading from selections from What the Poets Are Doing, myself from the BCP anthology, and also Douglas Walburn-Goff, who is also here, former guest, current guest.
Friend of the podcast.
Yeah, currently in a rocking chair and quietly just like watching things happen. Excellent Sunday vibes going on. Welcome to Amanda Jernigan and Rob Taylor. We'll ask you to introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about the books you're bringing through town.
Awesome.
Rob and I have just simultaneously done the take it away, gesture. But in fact, I was given false credit for being the editor of really either of these books. I am an advisory editor to the Best Canadian Poetry series, but Rob was our guest editor in 2019, and he was really responsible for steering that ship in harbor. Mm-hmm. And Rob alone is the editor of what the poets are doing. So I do, in all fairness, think that Rob should take it away.
That was your, like, kind of introduction that was really past this. This is all we're going to do. God. And now you will introduce after. We will return to you. Or should I introduce both of us at this point?
Take it away, Rob.
Amanda Jernigan is a fantastic poet. She's the author of Years, Months, and Days from Biblioasis, which came out in 2018, Groundwork, and All the Daylight Hours, which came out 2011 and 2012.
Something like that.
I think I know your bio better than you do. And is just a brilliant, brilliant, beautiful poet. And also teaches creative writing at St. Mary's University in Halifax, which is what got me out here, because I was doing the writer in residency at St. Mary's last week. And I will now introduce myself. I'm Rob Taylor.
Welcome.
As Amanda mentioned, I edited these two anthologies, and I've written a few books myself before that. That's it. We're good. Onward.
Nicely done. I could not have done it by myself.
So can you tell us a bit about the two anthologies?
So the Best Canadian Poetry Series has been running for quite some time now. Better than a decade, I believe. It was begun by Molly Peacock, the wonderful poet who arrived in Canada from the United States and looked around and wondered why there wasn't a Best Canadian Poetry Series, because she was, you know, enthusiastic about the Best American Series. Mm. And so she decided to start one, and she ran it for many years on her own and then brought on the fabulous poet and editor Anita Leahy to help her out. And now Molly has stepped back and Anita runs the series. But Anita sort of brought me in at a certain point to have as a sidekick. So Anita's the captain, and I'm not the, you know, the co-pilot or even the navigator. I'm sort of like the rat, you know? But I really like working with Anita, who's wonderful. And one of the things that's best about the series, besides getting to work with Anita every year, is that every year we get to work with someone else different. Mm. You know, there's a different guest editor for the series every year. And what that means is that the series tends to have quite a different feel every year. The book has a different feel every year. So every year we publish an anthology, the Best Canadian Poetry of 2018, 2019, 2020. And our guest editor is asked to read to the best of their ability, everything by Canadian that's been published in a literary magazine here or elsewhere in that year, and to select initially a long list of around 150 poems,
wow,
and then to sort of bring it to the table. And Anita and I kind of, as Rob put it, we sort of do talk therapy with the guest editor while they get it down from 150 to the 50 that will fit in the book, and then that comes out as the anthology for that year. So, so you know, it's the best Canadian poetry, but really what it ends up being is in some sense a portrait of the editor who selects it. You know, this year we have Rob Taylor's best Canadian poetry. Next year we get to have Marilyn Dumont's best Canadian poetry.
Oh, wow.
And the year before Rob, we had Hua Wen's best Canadian poetry. And
yes.
And each one of those editors picked a fantastic selection, and each one of them did something quite different with the book.
Mm.
So, I mean, for me, it means I get to be, you know, as the stowaway on the best Canadian ship, I get to have a sort of front row seat on the reading practices and proclivities of some amazing Canadian poet year after year.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful, you know, privilege to have that vantage. And we had a lot of fun working with Rob.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you mentioned at the reading that you read something like 2,100 poems.
Yeah, I think it was 2,133.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. I broke it down to, I think it was 1 hour over the time, which doesn't sound that bad, except that includes sleeping, eating,
oh my
raising
goodness.
My children, all that. So really, when you actually got an hour to read, you were cramming a lot of poems in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you're wanting to read them, you know, 3 or 4 times at least, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
if they might have a chance, you know.
Yeah.
You're really, so you end up reading them many, many times. And I found the difference, like, if you judge for, like, say, a book contest or something, where you're reading along in a book, and maybe you can tell 10 pages in, 15 pages in, it's not doing it for you.
Yeah.
But this is like every poem is a brand new chance, you know, it's a brand new thing to read. So it was an experience.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that feel compared to, did it feel, well, obviously drastically different from your previous reading practices, but.
Yeah, I mean, well, just the volume, just the how you can't sit with something for very long, you know, and you just have to press on. But I'm a real believer in the general poetry collection. Right now, everything is themed.
Mm.
And so it did feel like that sense of like, okay, every poem isn't going to do it for me. Every poem isn't going to be amazing, but then I'm just going to keep reading and staying open to things and trying to listen to things, and something will emerge, you know, from that experience. So in that way, it was kind of similar to reading more general poetry collections and seeing what jumps out at you.
Yeah, and different too, like, when you're reading the slush pile, you're going through a lot of content. These poems have already been vetted for a literary magazine, so they're already considered of a certain quality, in a sense. So you're reading all these poems that are already kind of on this level of, they're at least going to be pretty good.
Yeah.
And maybe not, again, like you had mentioned, your cup of tea, but it's a very different exercise than what reading from a slush pile would be.
Well, I talk about that in the introduction to this one, that it's kind of the slush pile without slush. And my crude comparison was like going to the discount grocery store where like half the apples are bruised and, you know, and you're just looking for the one shiny apple, and then you grab it and you don't think about it after that, right? Versus going to the fancy Whole Foods where like every apple is pristine, because I think, you know, magazines lean on, is this poem competent? Is it kind of well-rounded? Is it all, you know? And then they're all like that. So now you're actually just looking for something different that'll catch your eye. It's not just about it being a round, shiny apple. It has to have something a little odd about it, a little unique about it. So it becomes a different type of reading than what you'll do with a slush pile, for sure.
Did you have like a particular criteria you tried to stick to, or did that shift over the reading?
No, I think I just read and recorded whatever it was that jumped out at me. You know, I feel like you do a lot of thinking beforehand when you're doing something like this. You think about your own, the things that you love, and maybe where your blind spots are and where your biases are, and you try to round that out as best you can. But then when you actually go into the process of reading, all you can do is read and respond. Like, you can't have a bunch of artificial, like, you have to just let yourself have a gut response to things. And then afterwards, you again look at what you did and say, you know, like, did I have blind spots? Did I have biases? What did I miss here, right? And so for me, that was like having just a bunch of BC poets. Like, I couldn't avoid having a bunch of BC poets. And I realized it was because if you know someone's name, when you're reading 2,100 poems, if you know someone's name, you can't help but wake up a little bit more when you read that poem, and that little bias filters through, right? So we had a lot of conversations in the talk therapy where I was like, I've met this poet before, so that's probably the reason it's here, I don't know. And then they would either say to me, yeah, that one's not so good, or they would say, oh, this one's, no, you're wrong, Rob, this one's great. And so that's why it's so valuable to have other eyes, you know, to help.
Yeah, it's funny that you've both kind of used the talk therapy metaphor a few times.
Yeah.
And it is very much, yeah, it feels pretty appropriate to what an intensive reading process would be.
Mm.
This is something I've talked about with other people who've done like first line reading and slush pile reading, how there isn't often that support when you're reading that much volume of poetry and whatever amount of emotional trials come with reading that. Both in terms of what's in the poems themselves and how you might react to them.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to build in that sort of like care relationship and like a community that supports you through the reading into the editing process.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, it would have been a very different experience without the two of them. Like far less enjoyable in a sense, because it's having people who see what you did and validate it and go through that, at least the back end of that journey with you.
Uh-huh.
I think that ethos of care, it's very Anita, you know, she's a nurturer, and that's how she was as a poetry editor of ARC magazine for many years. Mm-hmm. She brings that also to Canadian poetry, but also that was Molly Peacock, you know, she too was a nurturer and really tried to build, you know, what she called the best Canadian poetry family, you know, the idea that this was not an exercise in exclusion, but an exercise in inclusion, and that every year it would get wider and broader, you know, there's something so lovely about that.
Yeah, and I love that they choose a different guest editor, because so often with a lot of literary magazines, they might have a poetry editor that's been there for 15, 20 years, and that's when you kind of get this concept of the white whale, like those literary magazines that you try and get into, and you just can't get past that level, whereas with Best Canadian Poetry, it kind of gives you that renewed hope that every year, like, you're working to put something out that maybe that year's editor will really pick up on. So it's a very unique, kind of similar to how a contest runs, where the judges kind of change and it's a new perspective. It's a great way of kind of consciously avoiding the way poetry and literary magazines and things like that can have gatekeeping, even if unintentionally, when you have someone who's in that position, especially if it's established for long. It's nice when you have that changeover to different people. And then often that can result in more marginalized voices getting attention, which that's what we're really trying to push here on this podcast. It switches things up in a way that often for, especially people starting out, you might not get that chance for an emerging poet to get chosen for Best Canadian Poetry is like one of those big things. There's poets I'm sure that have been around for years that maybe Best Canadian Poetry is their white whale.
Yeah,
and it's interesting too with what you say about biases, like recognizing that each editor is going to have bias and tastes that won't, like certain poems just won't be for everyone.
Yeah.
And switching out the editors every year and having a new guest editor bring their vision and the way that they see poetry moving forward is really interesting, because then you get to see each anthology is like, this isn't just this year in poetry, this is this year filtered through this one reader's perspective and one writer's perspective, and getting to kind of examine what those backgrounds might be and why they might gravitate towards certain poems and styles is really fascinating. Must be interesting too in terms of region. There might be, like you mentioned, having kind of a bias towards BC poets that you're familiar with, but having different guest editors would kind of shift that regional focus that too easily with a lot of magazines, because they're based usually in one space, will have kind of a regional bias based on who's around and who knows that the magazine exists and submits to it regularly. Yeah, there's so much possibility in that idea of making space for a new guest editor each year to bring in what they want to see in the world in poetry. Yeah.
Well, just as an exercise, reading that sheer amount of poetry and looking over like what are recurring themes that keep coming up in all these different literary magazines, regardless of region, regardless of the poet's background. Like, that would be so interesting as just a practice to pick up on, like, whoa, climate change was a huge focus this year. It's just amazing what can come out and how poets can surprise you with how they can find new ways to speak about the same things, which I'm sure reading that much poetry, there probably is some poetry that would really mimic one another, but it always amazed me when I've read slush piles or manuscripts how you can get surprised still, even with things that have been topics we've been talking about for years, like Sue Sinclair, who also read at this event. She has a real preoccupation with this concept of beauty through a philosophy perspective, and it's one of those things we've been writing about for, I would imagine, since the existence of poetry.
Since the first poet that it's become like heretical to write about it at all.
So there's those topics that we find new ways still.
Did you find particular things in, like, patterns in the readings this year?
I mean, I always hesitate to say that this is what's happening in Canadian literature, because I think magazines only show a small percentage of what's happening, right? Like, I think magazines, some magazines more than others, will chase trends or will do what some other magazine is doing, or just have an editorial board that has a particular predilection for it. And so then other things, just, as you say, people have their white whales, and that means there's lots of writers who just are never going to appear in that magazine.
Exactly.
And so I don't like saying this is what's happening in Canadian literature per se, but because a lot of that is invisible. So in Best Canadian Poetry 2008, Stephanie Bolster said that quirky, noisy, dense, disjunctive poetry seems to be on the increase, and that there's almost no overtly political work. Right. Mm. And so using that as a reference point, we've really flipped entirely, which is kind of astonishing, because the year I was reading for was the 2018 year, so a decade later. And now most things are political. It's the political embodied in the personal. And a large portion of that is kind of either not engaged in some of those the elements of sound or density, or is intentionally muting that because the political or the personal thing that's being told is trying to be prioritized, as opposed to having to look through the sound and the density to try to understand what's happening in a poem, right? So I do think that's the big shift in magazines. Do I think that means that every writer is used to be writing the one and is now writing the other? No, I don't. I think both are still happening, and everything in between. But magazines have turned from the one to the other in a big way, for sure, I think.
That is really interesting, too, because magazines kind of occupy that weird space where they're publishing people who are very established, and at the same time, they're publishing people who have zero publications and anything in between.
Yeah.
And it is, like, it's such a fascinating form, and I love the way that magazines work in terms of capturing specific poems, sometimes even single poems or batches of poems, rather than a complete work, because it feels very much like they're capturing moments in that way and assembling these moments seen from the perspectives of so many different writers at different levels of their careers, usually. Yeah, so it is fascinating to see what the magazines are putting together and, like, what that as a whole is just kind of suggesting about that medium and the people who are contributing to it. Yeah.
And just the way the industry has changed in those years. Like, we have a lot of new literary magazines that weren't in existence before that do have very, like, themed issues that would we have Augur that is all speculative lit. We have Plenitude that's queer lit. Like, there are magazines that have come to the forefront now that have become, like, really renowned and are relatively recent that wouldn't have been around for our very first Best Canadian Poetry.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very different pool of literature than what it probably would have been when it first began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny, too, because there is such a range of different kinds of magazines and how they approach how they work, in that you have the university-based, more established ones that are usually a bit older, like the Fiddlehead, the Malahat.
Yeah.
And then you have online becoming this flourishing of tiny, tiny projects, sometimes just organized by one or two people, many of which go into print, but many of which don't. And they kind of run on whatever basis they can sustain. And they're still publishing just as urgent and just as important work as the more established ones, just on a different schedule and scale. So yeah, it must be really fascinating to see like the full range of that in over 2,000 poems all at once. Oh.
Yeah, and it's always changing. I remember, because I knew I needed the help, this year I sent, I think it was 7 magazines. I was like, these are 7 of the new magazines I learned started up this year, just so they'd be considered for the next year's.
Oh, wow.
And I had to do the same, right? Like, there's a list at the back of magazines that were there for the year before. And every year, a couple of them are dying, and 5 more are springing up in their place. And just keeping up with the magazines even is...
Yeah.
That's incredible, yeah.
For any poets out there that would like to see a relatively up-to-date list, CBC has a running list they do of new literary magazines and ongoing ones. And they're pretty up-to-date. And if you notice that your magazine isn't on there, you can always email CBC and let them know. But that's one I recommend to a lot of emerging writers if they're looking where to send their work. Is there's this huge CBC compilation in alphabetical order of, like, there must be, like, 100 different magazines on that list.
There's, the, like, even better. There's a list at the back of Best Canadian Poetry
where
you can get the most up-to-date edition that you can.
Excellent.
I think I read 81 magazines. The poems. Yeah. A few of those weren't Canadian, but
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to bring up too was right after the anthology launched, you published a blog post featuring kind of a second list of poems that you wanted to include, but that didn't actually make it into the anthology. But you still made room for those names and the poems and a list of what magazines they were coming from. So I wanted to ask you about that. And
that's standard. Mm-hmm. The list is always there from the beginning. They always have had a 50 long poem long list. And I think, I mean, you'll be able to speak better to both of us. That decision predates both of us. But I think the idea was to kind of widen the circle a little more and include more magazines, include more names. But do you want to talk to it?
Yes, I mean, my understanding is that, you know, the 50-poem cutoff is somewhat arbitrary, but also tied to publishers' budget lines, you know, and the page count that they're willing to ante up for. But the understanding is that, you know, by the time you're dealing with those poems on the long list, you know, the ones that have already sort of risen to the top of the, you know, 2,000 plus that the editor has read, I mean, those are all worthy poems. Mm-hmm. And so... I don't know how far back the practice goes, but certainly for all of the years that I have been involved, in addition to the 50 poems in the book, there's a list of other notable poems, usually about 50, sometimes more, sometimes less, depending on how many the guest editor feels really deserve to be mentioned. And sometimes, you know, I mean, it's a way of involving, you know, sort of widening the embrace, giving credit to these other poets, poems, magazines. Sometimes you have situations where there's a poet who's had quite a number of really strong poems in the magazines that year, and you want to acknowledge that. You know, you're not going to put them all in the book because you wanted to give other people some stage time, but you want to show that actually, you know, we were entertaining 2 or 3 poems by this person, you know, for the book this year. So so that list serves a number of functions, but it has been a thing for at least the few years that I've been around.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to read that too, and like, very biased comment here, but I, as a poetry editor at the Fiddlehead, was really impressed by the number of poems on that list that were from the Fiddlehead.
Yeah.
I was really pleased to see that those poems are finding connections and making connections with readers.
Well, yeah, I think it does show my biases, my aesthetic overlaps with the Fiddlehead. I mean, there were lots of magazines I was really surprised by. There's a bunch of content from the Capilano Review in there, which is a magazine that I've always thought... You know, but I think I've had this aesthetic divide from a bit, but I think because of how things are changing and how content is being emphasized more and more, like there's more different connections that are opening up between magazines and aesthetics and And I put it online. I think it was the first time it's been put online. And I asked permission, can I put the backup list online? Is that okay? And I guess nobody just ever thought of doing it or something. And I just thought, I knew this existed. I knew every year it came up, I would like find it in a bookstore and see if I had something in the back, you know. But I thought a younger generation of writers might not know, and just to let them know, and hopefully a few of them who might not have ever known that they were listed back there would find out that way. Because the first time I was long listed back there, it was just amazing. It was just, you know, and it wasn't a publication or anything, but just knowing someone saw and appreciated my poem meant so much. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to try to get it to those 50 people, you know.
Anything like that makes a difference to a poet.
Oh, completely, yeah.
I'm always the first person to tell people, like, oh, if you'd like their poetry, like, tell the person, like, let them know. You don't have to write a Goodreads review. Like, if you feel like it, please
find
do.
Find their email address and send them a nice email and you will change their life.
Yeah. You know? Talk about it on social media. Say, this was a killer poetry collection, or this was an amazing poem. Like, there's no harm that comes out of hyping poets up. Outside of, like, maybe you'll become, like, best friends.
You gotta watch those poetry goes, you know? You can't pump us
don't
up
blow
too
them
big.
Up too hard.
Yeah. But especially for something that's, like, being drawn from magazines, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of emerging writers, it is really amazing to hear that people are reading it.
Yeah.
To hear that people are reading stuff that you've published that you didn't think would have a chance, and then somehow made it into a small magazine, and then into this anthology. It's just mind-boggling to get any kind of response, let alone response on that scale. Mm. So I really, I've had a lot of feelings about being included in this anthology, particularly for the poem that did. It's a poem that came out of some difficult conversations with other writers about the way that the writing community isn't safe for a lot of us. And to have that included in a place like this, and then to hear people responding to it, is absolutely incredible, and, like, has started up a lot of other conversations that I never would have had the chance to have otherwise.
Great.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful to hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, Douglas, I am running this podcast now. I'm so glad we have you here as a special guest. And you were reading at the event today, and you have a poem in Best Game Poetry, and I was wondering if you could tell us about the poem or your experience having it published in the anthology. Or
I might have you pause, Douglas, just while that big-ass truck moves in.
That was the truck doesn't want me to take over your podcast.
This it is objects. The Rob Taylor takeover.
Yeah.
We fully endorse it.
Well, getting the email from Meg Coles was, that was, wow, okay. Not something I expected whatsoever. It was very kind enough just to get, I think, 4 poems in that particular issue of Riddle Fence, which was, oh, wow, okay, 4 more published poems, as well as, like, the honorarium that comes per page.
Yeah.
I was already pretty darn happy about that. And Riddle Fence was, for me, one of the white whales for a number of years.
Yeah.
And has, since been very kind to me. And now, of course, I've recently been asked to be on staff, which is also, wow. But then, I've seen other writers I really love in this anthology in previous years. Like, you know what? Someday that's gonna work. I'm gonna try to do that. I don't know how it all works, but if that can happen. And then 9 months later, and from a poem that I didn't really think was one of the ones that I would call my better ones or strongest ones or ones I'm most attached to, but I've actually come to see that one of the new ones I read today holds a very big parallel with that one, in that they're the only two in which I decided physics doesn't matter, and sometimes people become 150 feet tall and they sit on islands and contemplate the islands across from them that are like a whole ferry right away, but in this poem I see them with my eyesight. Or in the one I read today, my father is suddenly tall enough that he gets stars caught in his beard when he stands full height. So perhaps BCP 2019 has allowed me to recognize that poem for myself as something that I wouldn't have necessarily recognized as a poem that I put as much as my own faith into, despite being the person who wrote it.
Yeah. That's really cool.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. One of the things that came out of the readings, too, was talk about emotion. I think Susan Clare started it by reading parts from what the poets are doing, excerpts where the writers interviewed are talking about emotion explicitly and how they feel about emotion in poetry. And then that came back in your reading when you kind of, like, introduced yourself as, like, the bleeding heart of poetry right now.
Well, in Sue's workshop.
Yeah.
Basically every time we talk, whether it's the poem that I've brought or if it's not my turn that week, what I'm going to say about the poem, and then it gets to me and Sue will say, I have a feeling I know what you're going to like and not like about it.
Yeah,
I'm a big softy, and I don't really mind wearing that in the poem full on.
Mm-hmm. I love what you said about how you weren't expecting to hear that you had gotten into this anthology. I think that's one of the coolest things about the best Canadian poets, is that it's not something you apply to. It's not something that, like, anyone else puts you up for. It's not the literary magazines that are putting you up for it. It's just a guest editor reading through thousands of poems and picking them out, which is so, so unique. So often, like, when you're trying to get your poetry recognized, whether it's a collection up for a prize or entering a contest, it's this, it's kind of on the poet to take that initiative or on the publisher to take that initiative. With the best Canadian poetry, it's just one of those, like, oh, hey, did you know that you made it in best Canadian poetry this year?
It really sneaks up on you. I don't remember when, I think it would have been about last year around this time that the emails went out about that. And I remember seeing this email from an address I didn't recognize and thinking, like, what is this? Is this like spam? And I read it and was completely, like, completely snuck up on by this entirely. Because, yeah, I had no idea how the process of it worked. And let alone that it would ever land on my weird, angry witch poem from Poetry is Dead. Thanks to Poetry is Dead for doing that issue also.
All right, Poetry is Dead.
Poetry is Dead is dead. had a good run.
And like Rob was saying, there's these new magazines that pop up, magazines that have been established for years that are taking a break or going on pause or dying.
Dying in a glorious blaze for Poetry is Dead, I think. Shall we talk a bit more about what the poets are doing?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the book a little bit there. What the poets are doing is an anthology that I put together the year before Best Canadian Poetry. And it features conversations between Canadian poets. And it's modeled after a book that came out in 2002 called Where the Words Come From that Tim Bowling edited. Same, it came from Nightwood Editions, just like this one. And that one had kind of all the poets who had accumulated through the 70s and 80s, your Atwoods and Ondaatje's and P.K. Page and these kind of poets being interviewed by poets who were up-and-coming poets in the 90s.
Okay.
And so we kind of mirrored that style, but now it was the poets who came up in the 90s and the 2000s being interviewed by people who were kind of being establishing themselves right now. One of those poets was Amanda, who was the most, this is a lot, I didn't really worry about the established and emerging thing, and sometimes it got really blurry and sometimes they were about the same. And this was one of them where Amanda was like just slightly less emerged than Karen Soley. And
I think I'm going to put that on my... Just slightly less
emerged. What did you emerge from?
That is one of our favorite questions to ask.
Exactly. No, it's all that emerging nonsense is so silly. You know, we were just trying to find... But we were kind of trying to honor the other book while still. So you're like, So one of the pairings was Karen and Amanda, and then there were a bunch of others, including the afterword, which was by Sue Sinclair and Nick Thran, who we're both reading today, because they're a couple. So I told Silas White at Nightwood that I wanted to include them, and he said that was cheating, and we weren't allowed to do that. So then I said, can they write a weird afterword together? Like, it just as a way to get them in the book. And he said, I guess. And then I told those guys, and they thought it was weird, but they also agreed to it. So this strange afterword was formed. But Amanda, I'll leave it to you to talk about your experience, because all I did was send a million emails, like, stressing people out about you're late for your deadline. I need more words. Keep talking to each other.
Like, I'm just talking to each other.
Endless spreadsheets and stress and phone calls. And I didn't actually go through the process of the conversations. That's Amanda's space.
Well, it's such a treat to be asked to have a conversation with someone you would like to have a conversation with. You know,
yeah,
that was a treat. I don't know Karen personally. I didn't. You know, when we were invited to embark upon this conversation together. So it was sort of like, you know, a friend who has connections at the embassy getting you into a good dinner party or something like that, you know. I was really pleased to be asked to take part. And I was pleased, too, because, you know, in preparing for the conversation, I just read everything of Karen's. And that's how I like to read. I'm not really a breadth reader, actually. I'm a depth reader. You know, I really like, if I become interested in the work of a writer, to read the whole thing, you know? And a friend of mine, the late poet Richard Outram, once said that, you know, he felt that one of the most important elements of an education is to find one writer whose whose sensibility and voice and oeuvre speaks to you. And then you read it all. And if you can, also read everything they read. Now, you know, I've actually been walking down that path with Richard for many years now, you know, reading all of his work. And of course, I'll never read everything he read, but, I've read a lot of things he read. And I couldn't go there with Karen, you know, read everything she read, but I did read pretty much everything that she's published in her books anyway. Mm. And I loved that, you know, just the excuse, really, to do a deep dive in another poet's work.
Mm.
And then to be able to sit down and talk to that person. It's just such a privilege. Though Karen and I are both very shy, I think, basically. You know, I don't know if that's the word she would use for herself. It's the word I'd use for myself. I think at one point she does say, you know, I say, oh, I don't think we've met. She said, yes, but maybe we both skulked around the edges of the same rooms at literary events. And I think that's true. We're maybe both kind of skulkers in that way. So our conversation is kind of funnily, mawkish and formal, I think. But we really had a lot to talk about as well, you know. And in particular, I think our resonances among the recent projects that each of us has been embarked upon. So Karen's latest book, The Keepley Caves, which was in manuscript at that point, sort of a meditation on the solitary work of poetry, but also the contemplative work of religious solitaries, you know, in the part of Scotland in which he was staying at the time, in the village of Crail. And I was thinking a lot about liturgical material as well. And my own recent work was sort of meditating on hymn texts, on liturgical stories and passages. And so we found a lot to talk about. It was funny, we were two solitaries talking about solitude. But we found a kind of fellowship in that, I think. Yeah.
I love the whole premise that you're pairing these poets together. And they just get to, like Amanda said, deep dive, get to know one another, get to know what writing is being done. And just the concept, I love how Amanda described it, of like getting into a poet's work and not just like their own writing, but what they were reading. One of my favorite things to do when I find a writer I really love is see if I can access what they're like, if they did go to grad school, what their theses were.
Oh, yeah.
Which my poet that, as Amanda said, we all have that poet who we read like everything they've ever written and try and read the things that they've also read. Mine is Tammy Armstrong.
Yes.
And I remember being able to track down Tammy's graduate thesis when I was writing my own and just being like, oh, here we go. This is what I needed.
Yeah.
Just to really get into the mind frame that she was in when she was writing and the influences. So I love that concept of like, not only appreciating the poet for their work, but what is driving that work, what influences are there.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of have fun on this podcast finding the weird influences, the ones that aren't literary or like getting into the, what inspired this poem? Oh, well, I was on a bus going from this province to that province, like the strange things that can have an effect on what you're writing or putting out.
The weird hallucinations after getting too much soup, the dishes, and passing out your bed. That sort of thing. Which is probably what I'm doing tonight, actually.
Yes. This is probably a question we should save for the dumpster dive, but while it's in my mind, now I need to ask Rob, Rebecca, Douglas, who are your poets that are that, like, you've read everything they've put out?
Who?
I mean, well, two of mine are Karen Soley and Sue Sinclair. So those two are pretty, I mean, mine are pretty on the surface with this book in the sense that I gravitate to people who I'm very interested in.
Mm.
And I was gravitating to people, not just who I like their poetry, but I like what they have to say about poetry and the way they carry themselves in the writing world, you know, because I wouldn't say that every poet here is that's in this anthology is my favorite poet, but I like them all. They're writing at least a little bit, and I really like the way that they hold themselves and the way that they are able would have a conversation with somebody. So people like Sue, someone like Russell Thornton is also another one who would be in that list for me too. And so then I just invited them all into this book.
Douglas, do you have a...
I'm thinking of a few. I've never actually done the deep dive through all of someone's. I was thinking about this the other day. Just looking at my shelf, and it's always a disarrayed mess. I just come to things randomly. I have a habit of, like, if I'm out for a walk, I'll just duck into a bookstore. And I usually, like, crack the middle of a book, read a few lines, see if it, you know, catches me. Sometimes I'll see recommendations online. There are a few people I know whose tastes are similar to mine, and I'll get a text, hey, you should really check this out. Mm. I really enjoy Don McKay's writing about writing and about wilderness. Mm. Always been a big fan of that. And John Stuffler was the first teacher I had, so I've read quite a bit of his work as well in terms of the poetry. And also one of the only people really... maybe this podcast will get somebody out of the woodwork to say, no, you're missing somebody. But in terms of that face and eyes into tactile engagement with Southwestern Newfoundland sometimes as character within a piece of writing, but I think he might be the only other one that I know of anyway that I've come across. And so, of course, that was directly appealing to me. But then I get off on tangents where I know that, like, when Adele Barclay's new book came out, it's like, I don't even need to crack the cover. I'm going to buy that.
Renaissance Normcore, which is actually sitting on Jenna's coffee table at the moment.
In a beautifully curated way.
Yeah.
Look at all the colors on this. This is perfect.
It currently matches the coasters on your table.
Mm-hmm. My living room is very, very pastel. And Adele's book just...
Right?
It fits.
When a book is as beautiful in design as it is in terms of the poetry that's contained within, I just felt like that design matched Adele so perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a gorgeous cover.
Rebecca.
Yeah. I feel like I'm also a little bit scattered in terms of what I pick up on and what resonates with me. And I think this is partly because I have been reading slush piles and editing poetry. Such, like, most of my reading, I think, is slush piles and poetry editing work. And there's so much of that single poems or single lines will resonate with me for years and years and years. In terms of writers that I follow almost religiously, Carmen Maria Machado, author of, not a poet, but very gorgeous, gory, lyrical writer of Her Body and Other Parties and In the Dream House and several short stories and essays in between. Everything about her writing hits me so hard and in a place that I didn't know I had access to. So I feel like I need to just immerse myself in her world and in her imagination, because it's doing so many things that I couldn't articulate about how my own writing wants to work, but couldn't.
She's also a bit of a structure nerd in a way that poets like, I think.
Oh, completely.
Like,
yeah.
Each story, like that, the way we think about shape and how the shape of something is going to influence the meaning, which is something that I think a lot of fiction writers just, you know, don't consider actively. You can see the way that she goes after that.
Yeah, her entire memoir, In the Dream House, each chapter is kind of titled Dream House as archetype, Dream House as science fiction novel, Dream House as so-and-so other form. And she goes through these variations on telling this story or trying to tell this impossible story by using form to pick out what might be tellable in each form. And it's really fascinating how she moves through that. It does read very much like a kind of poetic concept overall. I think that's maybe my main poet slash writer that I love to dive into and see their world. Also, maybe Tommy Pico, because I have loved a lot of his poetry. I think Nature Poem was the first of his. He has a tetralogy of really like exuberant gay poetry through this character he calls Teebs. And that's the speaker through all these four books of long poems. And it's such an exuberant voice and way of encountering the world and loving things, but also feeling complicated about your relationship and complicity with the world. And that kind of comes through as well in a lot of the podcasts he's part of. Shout out to Food for Thought and also Scream Queens, in which he and Drea Washington talk about horror movies. Yes. And it's been like my latest like comfort listen, as much as it's about like gory horror movies. I detect a theme in my own preferences lately, but you know. Yeah.
I'm going to read the prologue to my book, Years, Months, and Days. These poems are small meditations on midnight hymns. I call them Meditations on the Possibility of Translation. And this prologue is in six short parts, so I'll pause briefly amongst them. Oh, you who know my will, but do not understand it, and must be driven still in restlessness, or stranded. Your soul will not be still until you are resigned how gentle is your friend and kind. I can see the place, near to me as you are, clearly as your face, but I cannot go there. You see, I've come so very far from nothingness that now I cannot see it for you. See, I've come so very far from nothingness that now I cannot see it for. Carry my come to me, cross with your burdens. Carry my come to me, cross with your burdens. By your light lead me, for I am blinded. By your light lead me, for I am blinded. Alone I ask, who shrives the heart? Alone I ask, who shrives the heart?
During the New Brunswick Book Awards last year, Amanda had this phenomenal keynote wherein she spoke about buying the farm and how it's so often a metaphor for death. And I was at this event with my boyfriend, and afterwards he goes, Jenna, we need to buy the farm. We need to listen to Amanda and buy the farm. So this has been a constant conversation for us about how we just want property where we can have bees and keep animals and have a little orchard. And thank you, Amanda, for reading from your lovely collection. And I've been meaning to tell you how lovely your keynote was from that award ceremony.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you for coming. Poor Amanda and Rob had some vehicle trouble coming from Petacodiac to Fredericton yesterday.
Yeah. Yes, so our vehicle nearly bought the farm.
Yes, returned the farm,
but you made it, which is what matters.
Yes, we're
it was 13 hours from Halifax to Fredericton, I think.
Goodness,
but it was good company. So,
did you go from Petacodiac to Halifax to Fredericton?
We went to Halifax to Petacodiac, then we went around in a circle for a while trying to get a new car, and then finished it off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've never been to the Maritimes, and I had a proper Maritime novel.
That is
stranded
accurate.
On the side of the highway in the middle of nowhere. You
yes,
know?
So, middle of winter.
That sounds about right for
just
the Maritimes.
Just wind whipping through my bones, yeah.
The only thing that would have made it any more maritime is, like, if a moose just came up on the shoulder of the highway.
Or, like a Donair truck or something.
Moose riding a Donair truck would be
like. My father has made Donair meat from moose meat.
Sounds delicious. Yes.
Is this what happens in every podcast? You just eventually talk about donairs. It's just a natural moment.
Usually some kind of food.
Yes, we did have a food porn special our last Valentine's Day where we talked about the sexiest food Fredericton has to offer. Where are you both eating tonight? Rob and Amanda are going out to supper after this. Let's see if it's one of the sexiest food places in Fredericton.
Well, obviously, because we're going to Sue and Nick's house.
It doesn't get sexier than eating at the Canlit power couple's house.
So. Yes. Very true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
I will read a poem. It's from The News, which is a book of mine that came out with Gaspro a few years ago. And it's a poem a week I wrote during my wife's pregnancy with our first child.
Mm.
And I chose this poem because it's a poem about building community, and I so appreciate what you guys do on this podcast and all the podcasts that are coming about these days, and also just a revival of
kind of positive, productive social conversation between writers, you know? Like, a few years ago, what the poets were doing, it was kind of coming out of a we're not talking right now kind of feeling, you know, and wanting to try to instigate that. And now I feel like, even a couple of years later, it's kind of happening more organically and more things are happening. So I just really appreciate that, because my sense is it doesn't always happen. Sometimes it happens, and then sometimes we kind of go quiet. So I'm glad about that. Anyway, so then I wanted to read this poem, which is kind of connected to that, but then I realized it's also very sad. But, you know, that's poetry. So this is 24 weeks. It's like, you know, whatever that is. A little more than half of the way through the pregnancy. And I heard a talk by the poet Kwame Dawes, the American poet. And he was talking about, someone asked him why he edited, it was Prairie Schooner, I can't remember what it was, one of the magazines he's associated with, and basically said, nobody reads literary magazines, why are you wasting your time? Like, it was a very blunt question that somebody asked him from the audience. And he kind of, he worked his way to his answer, and he said, well, you know, it's a home that you make for other people that they can come to and spend time in. And then he said, and this is the quote, if you build a home, you can live in that home, right? So that he was doing this thing for others, but he was really also doing it for himself. And I thought that spoke to what all of us are doing, what you guys are doing, and what any of us are doing in literature too.
Yeah, I love that.
So 24 weeks, if you build a home, you can live in that home. My baby, your mother and I are building your home. We are volunteer laborers. We have nothing to offer you but this. We hope it will be enough. We hope you will let us live in this new home with you. My baby, your mother and I are singing you a song. We are leaning in, singing into one microphone. Our voices are joining in the air before electrifying down the cord to you. That is why we sound like one person. My baby, your mother and I are digging your grave. We will not finish it, but we are starting it. We're digging with our hands without knowing it. We're digging with our voices without meaning it. It is our duty, our honor. My baby, I ask you to be a volunteer laborer. I ask you to finish our grave with such precision that we cannot tell it from our home, that by the end, they will have become one place.
Yeah. I think the whole room is speechless after that.
Yeah.
Little dark, depressing end. Yeah. No, I think of it as a very positive poem that says the word grave a lot. But yeah.
I think it was Anique McCaskill who recently just she shared one of your poems, and I think it was another poem about a baby.
It was the first poem from this book.
Yeah. And I remember reading that, and like there's a really like genuine tenderness that runs through those, and like talking to this person that isn't born yet, and like you're trying to imagine who that might be and what their possibilities will be. And it's really, really lovely to see that perspective be so honest.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. This actually was a big part of the conversation at the reading about like, what do we do with feelings and emotions and why have they been left out of poetry for so long?
You're allowed to use that emotion in poems. And I think that's part of like, maybe it's formal education around poetry that can often kind of try and stifle that or equate it with cliche, but I don't think there's anything cliche about something that genuinely human.
I think it's a fear of vulnerability and effort.
Yeah.
And maybe that makes me sound like an arsehole.
Yeah, there is also definitely like a political dimension to it where, like what you said about for like the first few years of the Best Canadian Poetry Anthology were more about the sound and less about the political and the personal. Mm. And we're having a swing back into that as the world becomes more political and urgent.
Yeah.
And sentiment and feeling and the body are coming back in those ways because they are urgent and felt and immediate in ways that I think more comfortable times have not allowed us to really appreciate.
Yeah.
And having earnestness come back and that genuine care in poetry, I think, is a really fascinating move as a response to the like uncaringness of the world at the moment. Yeah.
Thank you both so much. Before we let you go, we'll have our quick like fast food version of the dumpster dive, which is one urgent question. Who is your favorite canlit power couple? We're going to do poetry power couple, but we'll open it up a bit.
I want
to
claim Nick and Sue, because Nick Thran and Sue Sinclair, because I did pair them up in a book to try to cement that legacy going forward.
We're also one of the sexiest places to like eat in Fredericton.
Sexiest place to eat, power couple. They're on all the lists. Yeah.
One of my power couples is David Seymour and Danny Couture.
Yes, both fantastic poets, both longtime Poetry Weekend attendees and revelers. And, wonderful people to have around. Amanda, do you know what your answer is going for?
Graphic novelist named Sylvia Nickerson writes, "We're born, then we die." In between, it's mostly about who has power over whom. When you love, you give your power away. It's the most beautiful thing. It's the scariest.
Yeah.
That's my answer.
She's pulled us out of the dumpster single-handedly.
Yes. I suppose now I have to follow that with my own. Yeah, I'm going to give a shout out to a couple of local power pairings. Trini Finley and Lucas Crawford, who we had on an episode that was lost, and we will have to have back on the podcast at some point.
Yes.
And shout out also to close friends Colin Johnson and Lauren Korn, both of whom are excellent poets, brilliant people, and have maybe the best comic timing of any couple that I've ever met. So, shout out to all those people who are doing excellent poetry things.
We also mentioned while we were on break, Carly Baker and Sean Cranberry, who are BC. Is that
BC, correct? That is correct. Yeah. They're just a little, you know, it's too cute and gross. The people I know, you know, well, like Mallory Taylor and Curtis LeBlanc are also... Yes. I love them all. They're all wonderful, but it's, you know, they're just, it's too cute.
It is. Buy all their books. We want to do a special shout out. Mallory just released her debut novel, The Birthyard, which is phenomenal. I've already messaged Mallory demanding a sequel. And Curtis has a new collection coming out with Nightwood Editions, who put out What the Poets Are Doing that Rob was the editor for. So shout out to Nightwood, friend of the podcast. And... to Curtis and Mallory.
Can I just, while we're talking about this, just make a recommendation for like young aspiring poets who are trying? So find someone who has a dental plan. You know, like, it's, I know this is really cute what we're saying about like power couples, like, and more power to them. But you know, if you have to choose, if you're starting fresh, it's choose someone with a dental plan. But,
yeah, there is like something lovely about loving poets, but then you realize how much money you're not making together.
It is so true. I just played Matchmaker last night for a few poet friends who I will not name because I love them very much. Yeah. But they're both poets, and I was like, yes, this will either end a disaster or be disgustingly adorable.
Yes.
Thank you both so much.
Yeah, thanks to Douglas for being
here. Thank you so much for having us. Yeah.
Special guest.
Yes, shout out to Douglas. Where can people find you on social media?
And or your books.
Oh,
and
this
or
is a books. Great question for Amanda. Do you exist on social media in any way, shape, or form?
No.
Yeah. Honestly,
but my,
amazing.
My books are available through a thing called the mail. And your local independent bookseller can order them
out to Westminster Books.
Yeah. I'm RobLucasTaylor.com and just RobLucasTaylor anywhere. Just put that in. There's too many Rob Taylors. There is another Rob Taylor in Canada who's a poet who publishes as Rob Taylor Poet, who I have to.
Okay.
The middle name is very important.
Now I need to be 100% sure.
Yeah.
Are you Rob Taylor? I've eaten the plums that were in the ice box.
Yeah, yeah,
Rob
yeah.
Taylor? Okay.
Unfortunately, that is. I'm sorry that's become canonical, but yeah. Yeah, I went through that for about a year. Well, you know, I think we all have...
Oh, I think it's still ongoing.
No, I retired. I have resisted since the beginning of the year. It's my New Year's resolution. But
to no longer
it's been hard with all the coronavirus parties. Stuff to not have plum coronavirus jokes. No, it was just a love... Yeah, that's me. I love-hate relationship with social media and what the heck am I doing on this? And, you know, And so having something that stupid that I could turn to made it doable for a while.
I feel like poetry Twitter has some pretty good meme content. Yes. Like that. Parodies of other poems. Mm. Stuff like astrology poems.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Astro poets and that sort of thing. And just generally wittier jokes. Mm. I'll give it that. The fighting is a whole other thing, but you know. Live for the memes.
Come for the memes, stay for the fighting. Yeah.
And then quit over the fighting. Yes. And never look at social media again.
All right. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure getting to meet you both again and in person.
These are the best days of our lives.
So, just as an afterword, we want to state that Elman Ampersand stands in solidarity and supports the actions of land defenders standing in support of Wet'suwet'en and the ongoing opposition to pipelines and promotion of Indigenous rights and title. For any of the land defenders out there, many of which are poets, we are with you, we support you, we see you, and we want to support what you are doing. So, shout out to all of those people who are doing that work. And those who are contributing to it and supporting those land defenders in the work they're doing.
If you'd like to find out more information on how you can be an ally and support the land defenders in the Wet'suwet'en, on our social media, our Twitter is @elm_ampersand. We will have all of the toolkits posted. There's also currently a promotion going on with Elm and Ampersand that if you make a donation to their legal fund and send either the Facebook page, Twitter page, or me personally the proof that you made a donation, you will get the opportunity to have some poetry edited, and you can feel free to reach out to me personally at Jenalyn Albert on all social media with that proof that you've made a donation. It's just one of those things that it's incentive for people to donate, and it's not every day you can have another poet look over your work. So if you're feeling like doing a positive thing and would also like to get a little something back for that money, please, please, please make a donation to the legal funds. And like we said, we'll post the toolkit, which will have lots of other resources on how you can help.
Mm-hmm. And if you aren't a poet or are interested in checking out more of those initiatives, plenty of artists, including a lot of Indigenous crafters and artists, are offering solidarity donations with Wet'suwet'en. You can probably find quite a few of them, including some that may be in your area, by searching through hashtags like Artists for Wet'suwet'en and hashtag Wet'suwet'en Strong.
Elm and Ampersand is produced and edited by Jenna Knorr. Special thanks to this week's guests, Amanda Jernigan, Rob Taylor, and Douglas Walburn-Goff. Intro music and additional music were by Adam Washburn. Elm and Ampersand is hosted by Jenalyn Albert and Rebecca Salazar. This podcast is made possible thanks to the City of Fredericton. And please, wash your hands.